I'll call the House Hess Committee to order right now. It is about 3 minutes after 9 on March 15th, 2008. Let the record show that the members present are Representative Keller, Representative Faircloth, Representative Gardner, Representative Roses, and myself, Representative Wilson. And so we do have a quorum to conduct business. And I would like to recognize the staff today. Debbie. Debbie, the House Recording Secretary. Sammy is our LIO monitor. And Becky, who is not in the room right now, is, of course, is my Hess aide. And before we start, please turn off your cell phones, because if they stay on vibrate, it does interfere with the recording equipment over here. So the first thing on our agenda today is a presentation from the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development. And then we will bring, after that, we will bring up Senate Bill 119, the school library grant backup. And then the final bill on the agenda is House Bill 386, school energy subsidy. So Eddie, would you and Neil come forward and present your material? And explain, so I don't know if everyone in the audience understands what the Moore case is, so if you could kind of go into that a little bit also.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. And with me today is Neil Slotnick, the AG for the Department of Education.
Just a second. I see that Senator Olson is in the audience, and that we have extra room up here. So if you'd like to come forward, you're more than welcome.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, but I think I would confer with my chief person down here.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Eddie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the presentation that you're going to receive today is a result of the Judge Gleason's ruling in the Moore versus State case. Actually, we're going to get into it real quick here, so I'm not going to try and break it down for you because the very next chart that we have does break down the judge's ruling quite clearly and succinctly. So with that, I'm going to ask Neil to go ahead and start with the opening remarks about the lawsuit, and then we'll continue with our presentation.
Okay.
And if people have questions as we're going through, please let us know. So with that, Neil.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Wilson. I'm Neil Slotnick, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Department of Education and Early Development. And we're here today to tell you about the Moore case, which was one of the major education cases in this state's history, I think, along with the Molly Hooch case. You would say it's those are the two largest, most important education cases since statehood. And the Moore case was a challenge to Alaska's education system under what's called the Education Clause, which is in Constitution Article 7, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution, is the Public Education Clause. And every state in the Union has an education clause. And there have been many, many lawsuits filed in the last two decades in the lower 48 about education, quality of education under the Education Clause. Those are called adequacy lawsuits. And the theory of those lawsuits is that you have an education clause in your Constitution. It requires that the state provide an education. And therefore, that must mean that the education has to be adequate. And if kids aren't being educated, the education isn't adequate. The legislature is therefore in violation of the Constitution. What the Education Clause says is that the legislature puts the authority and the responsibility right on the legislature shall by general law establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state and may provide for other public educational institutions. Now, of course, the legislature here has provided for a system of public education, and you've done that by delegating the authority to local school districts. The local school districts have the authority to establish the schools, actually have the responsibility and the duty to establish schools, staff them with teachers, and to teach the children. And the theory of this lawsuit, of course, was that those aren't adequate. It's the legislature that's to blame, not the local school districts, because you're supposed to be involved. You're supposed to be providing and maintaining that education. I might mention that in the lower 48, these lawsuits, these adequacy lawsuits, have been very, very successful. That courts in many, many states have found that the education system was inadequate, that they've ordered restructuring of the education, and mostly they've ordered lots more funding for education, and that the funding has to come from a central source. And this lawsuit was largely about funding. What the plaintiffs were requesting was more funding for education. Essentially, they wanted to double the size of the education budget that this body appropriates at this time. And of course, once you file a lawsuit under the Education Clause, all aspects of education are under scrutiny, and that's what the judge did. She wanted to look at the adequacy of education, not just at the funding. And what she found after holding a month-long hearing and lots of evidentiary testimony, what she found was this. She found that the Education Clause really established, could really be broken down into a four-part test. There are four elements of an adequate education. The first is funding, that you have to have adequate funding in order to have an adequate education. She looked at the amount of funding that was available in the state, she looked at how it was distributed, and she made a finding that the legislature was in compliance with that prong of the Education Clause. There was adequate funding. We have about a $1.3 billion education budget. She found that to be adequate. The next thing she looked at was standards, that you can't just have a standardless go educate kids without saying educate them to what. You have to have some guidance, some direction given in the terms of standards. And as you know, back in 1990, Jerry Covey had started a movement to draft standards, that has been refined many times over the years. This is the most recent version that I have. It's an 05 version of the standards. We have committees that get together that determine what, for every grade level, what children should know and should learn. She looked at these standards. Both sides, experts actually testified that these were more than adequate. These were really very well done standards. She found that the legislature is in compliance on that prong of the Education Clause. Third thing she looked at was an assessment system, because you have to have feedback, you have to have an assessment system. And as you know, in 1998, this legislature adopted a requirement that there be statewide assessments, that they be given, and that in fact there be an accountability system that is tied to those assessments. And with the coming of NCLB, we now have a system of assessments that is offered in every year. We're able to track kids in grades 3 through 10. We're able to track kids' progress year over year. She found the assessment system to be adequate. But then she found a fourth prong. And the fourth prong was this. She said that the legislature can't just delegate the responsibility to local school districts and then turn its back. There has to be continual state oversight of what those local school districts are doing. And she looked at the evidence that was before her, and we'd had many superintendents come in and testify. We especially had looked closely at the three plaintiff districts. And what she found was that for most school districts in this state, the system of local control with the state oversight provided by the accountability system was working. That in most school districts, there truly was an adequate education and there was enough state involvement. But she looked at some of the outlying districts. There were some districts that just weren't getting the job done. The kids weren't learning sufficiently. And this was a long-standing problem, not a short-term problem. And in particular, she had a lot of evidence as to the Upit School District, because that was a plaintiff. Upit School District had been a plaintiff suing for more funding. And looking at the evidence that was in the record, she said, this is not enough state oversight. You've given Upit School District all of this authority to make all of these decisions. You're not exercising enough oversight over those decisions that they're making. You need to be in there more when you have evidence that the local control system isn't working. And she said she didn't limit her decision to Upit School District. She said there may be others. I don't have the evidence right now. It's up to you, state, to go out, re-examine this evidence, and come back and tell me which school districts are in the same boat as Upit. And so what she did, instead of immediately ordering a remedy, is she said, 1 year. I'm going to give the state 1 year to go out, determine what other school districts are in the same shoes as UPIT, and I'm going to give the state 1 year to fix this. You have to exercise more oversight. Come back 1 year from now and tell me what that oversight, extra oversight, is going to be. Now, that was the holding under the Education Clause. And I'm going to switch right now and go down to the Due Process Clause, because that's also implicated whenever you have in these education lawsuits, because the Due Process Clause, of course, guarantees you you have liberty rights and under the Due Process Clause. And what that affects,
Neil,
is...
Neil, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt here just before you get into the next session and recognize that Representative Sisna has joined us. Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. And, so under the Due Process Clause, there's a question of when can you tell a student that you can't get a high school diploma, because a student has a certain interest in that high school diploma because it's a valuable piece of property to him or her. This is all very complicated legal theory. What it comes down to is this. She made a finding that you can't, if there hasn't been a meaningful opportunity to learn in the student's school district, then you can't take the diploma away from that student. You can't use an exit exam, at least, to take that diploma away from the student, because they haven't had a meaningful opportunity to learn the material that's being tested. You come to school every day, you meet all the requirements for graduation, except you don't pass that exam, and you have never had the opportunity to learn what's on the exam, you can't use the exit exam to take that to take the diploma away. All of which I agree with. I will say for the record here, I do not agree, where I think there was a logical leap here, is that she's assuming that because there wasn't enough oversight in UPIT school district, there wasn't a meaningful opportunity to learn what's on the exit exam. And that is a logical leap that the state strongly disagrees with. But once, I will point out that the cure for this violation that she found is the same as the cure for this. If we do provide enough oversight so that she's satisfied that we're active enough in UPIT school district and the other school districts that might be in the same shoes, it'll cure this problem as well. So even though we disagree, that might not be that big of a problem for us as we go back. And here again, she gave us 1 year. Come back in 1 year, she said. Now, she issued her decision. Judge Gleason issued the decision in June. And so we now have another hearing scheduled in June. But when Commissioner Sampson, then Commissioner Sampson, received this ruling, his immediate reaction was, upon reading this holding here, that wasn't enough state oversight, was, wait a minute, she doesn't have all the evidence. This trial wasn't about oversight, it was about funding. We didn't put on the evidence of everything that we are doing in not just UPIT, but in other school districts as well. Because we have an accountability system. That accountability system has caused us to be active in school district, particularly in UPIT school district, and you'll hear about others, where we've actually intervened, where we've sent state employees or contractors out to the district. And what he wanted to do was immediately, not wait a year, immediately come into court and put on that evidence. My job is to do what the client says, so we filed a motion and said, let's have an immediate hearing. And we had a little a hearing about whether to have a hearing. And this is what the judge said back to me. And I stood up and said, Your Honor, we want to come in right away. There's evidence you haven't heard. And what she said is, no, take a closer look at my ruling, Mr. Slotnick. And I'll read you exactly what she said. She said that what she had done was put the ball back into the camp of the state government, the legislature, and the Department of Education to address the concerns that I articulated. And that's where I see the case is at this stage. If I'm hearing that the Department of Education says it's done everything that it's supposed to, well, that's a determination that they have every right to make. But ultimately, the constitutional responsibility is the legislature's. And if they choose to say, we think we're in compliance, great, I'll look at this case in June, and I'll go forward from there. If they choose to say, we better further address our obligation under the Education Clause, then that's what I'll take up when we meet again later next year. Does that help clarify my thoughts on this? Mr. Slotnick? I think so, yes. And so that we're clear, what we are saying is that there's evidence out there you haven't heard yet, the court. And I understand that completely, Mr. Slotnick. And you're saying back to me that when the legislature hears that evidence, and if it decides that's enough, you'll consider that. If they hear that evidence and decide they want to know more, then you'll have that record, the court. Exactly. So what Eddie's going to present to you is not just, he's going to show you that evidence that the court wants this legislature to hear, the evidence of what we're doing. And then he's also going to discuss a little bit, I think, the bill that Senator Stevens has proposed, because that is, after all, how this legislature takes action, how it's going to communicate to the court what it wants is through statute, through legislation. And, of course, you do have an accountability system. There is an oversight out there. There was also some evidence at trial that the Department of Education could use additional authority to implement that oversight system that you adopted back in 1998. And that's really where this legislation is. Eddie's going to explain where this legislation, this proposal that Senator Stevens has introduced, is going. And with that, I'm going to turn it over.
Just before you get started, Eddie, Representative Gardner has
Thank
a question.
Thank you. I have two questions. The first one's real easy. Could we get a copy of that exchange with Judge Gleason?
Yes.
Just I'd like to look at it and ponder it. And then the second one is, when we talk about opportunity to learn, what is the role and measurement of attendance there? Because obviously if kids aren't in school, it doesn't matter what the district's doing. If they're not there, they're not taking advantage of the opportunity to learn. And I understand that that is one of the problems in rural Alaska is attendance. So.
And through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's exactly right, and it's really not just attendance. Oftentimes there's problems with attendance. They will attend, but because they've not had enough sleep or they're not ready, they're not, you know, nutrition might be, there's all kinds of problems that are not the fault of the school district. And this isn't just rural Alaska, really. It's everywhere as well. And so that's why we're very careful to say that the test for constitutionality cannot be outcomes. We can't guarantee that kids are going to learn. All we can do is offer the opportunity. And so that's, but what she made a finding of was when you have a school district like UPIT, where there's a long-standing history of a lack of success. And furthermore, as I've said, we already were active in UPIT. And when we went out there, we did find that the school district perhaps, that there were deficiencies that we could help correct. And our people out there did that. For example, they helped educate the school district to not have so many programs, to concentrate on a few quality programs. What we found is that there were good teachers. There was a good curriculum in place. The teachers weren't necessarily using the curriculum, or they weren't necessarily trying to teach the standards through the curriculum, which they could have been there, but there because of the lack of training, perhaps wasn't. So you can improve the opportunity in a school district like that. We found that there was an ability to improve the opportunity to learn. On the other hand, Bering Strait School District, another plaintiff school district, there were also some schools that weren't showing a tremendous amount of success. And yet when we looked into it, we found that that school district was very well organized, very focused. It was employed the Success for All program, which is just one step at a time, and that they were doing everything that we know to do. Still not a lot of kids reaching proficiency, but the opportunity was there.
Follow-up, Representative Gardner?
Thank you. And just so I understand, is poor attendance a defense? Is that a factor that the court would take into account? I mean, or not? Does it matter?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes, that is a factor that the court would take into account. Did. She made findings about attendance. She made findings about sleeplessness, about cable TV, about other factors like that.
Thank you. Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question, I don't have a legal background, and And so I'm not quite sure how to get at the question, but I think it's an important one. And it seems to me in rights that in fact, our Constitution gives us, and that's kind of an important thing, equal but different is kind of incorporated into it. And I even look around this room, and we're pretty much all the same in a lot of ways. We have the same kinds of educational backgrounds, come from the same world. And in the state of Alaska, we have different worlds. There are different worldviews. And the schools in rural Alaska, if taught to the same in the same way for the same standards, are going to be very it would have to be different kinds of teaching, it would seem to, in my mind. Does that play a part in this at all? Is that is the fact that we are offering kind of the same thing in many situations that you downtown Anchorage in Minto, or in further than that in Accutane, or one of those communities farther away and very different?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, that's a very tough question as to how to find the balance. Certainly we do know that culturally appropriate education, methods of delivering education, is a strategy that is being followed right now in all throughout Alaska, whether it's in the Russian communities in the Kenai, or whether it's in Western Alaska communities. What we are finding is that there's certain approaches to learning that are successful, are helpful in the classroom. It's the breaking it down into smaller bits. It's the using of frequent feedback loop assessments. It's having blocks of time, uninterrupted time, for reading or math, where there will be no intercom announcements, there will be no interruptions. It's reading dedicated 90 minutes a day without interruption. Things like that help in all cultures. And those are the kinds of, I think, instructional strategies that we're teaching, our people are teaching when they're going out to the districts. Okay. As to where the legal line is, it's very, very difficult to draw. And the judge necessarily had to skirt that line.
It's a rough.
I have a question. What about the schools? And it sounds to me like we're basing most of this on the assessment system that we have through No Child Left Behind. And what about this? That's not true?
It's a state standard.
Madam Chair, if I may, we have to remember that the state of Alaska embarked on a standards and assessment system in 1998 prior to No Child Left Behind coming along. It just so happens that our system is very much aligned with No Child Left Behind, and so we took our system and expanded it to meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind. So when the legislature passed our assessment system back in 1998, it started with assessing children in grades 3, 6, and 8. Okay. Then when No Child Left Behind came along, we expanded that, so now we do 3 through 10.
Okay. And I guess what I meant was we're still using an assessment system that's connected. I mean, we're teaching the standards. I understand that. But the assessment system that we're using is the testing, and correct me if I'm wrong, that happens and that we put in place with No Child Left Behind, that test to see what each child and each school is doing each year?
Madam Chair, I still want to say it's the state's accountability system. In 1998, the state went to a standards-based accountability or assessment system in reading, writing, and math. Okay? No Child Left Behind came out and said, you got to establish an accountability system in your state in reading, writing, and math. Well, the state of Alaska was ahead of the curve on that.
Okay, well, then I'm not trying to say who's... So the state of Alaska, what I'm saying is the testing that you're using to check on those standards, the testing that we're using, and I could be wrong on this too, but the testing that we're using is testing that in the smaller schools, if you can identify some group of kids or one or two kids, we don't count that. Or it gets kind of because they could be identified. What I'm getting at is the judge said that Upiat School District was one of them that she was concerned about, and there may be others. And what I'm getting at, there may be others because we aren't counting some of that. If we were counting those because they could identify those kids, there would be more schools in that category that maybe might be having problems. And am I wrong, or where am I my thinking with that?
Madam Chair, through the court proceedings, I would say that at that point in time, the Department of Education was not actually drilling down to individual schools for the state accountability system purpose, okay? But what the judge has said is you have the data. You know when individual schools are not performing and consistently not performing. And the Alaska legislature has an obligation to help those schools. The obligation to operate and maintain public schools in Alaska is on the legislature. This chart here shows that the state's oversight and accountability system. I guess I need to back up a little bit because I really see the systems. We're using the same data to serve both purposes,
yes.
The state accountability system and NCLB. NCLB actually drills down into subcategories like special education, limited English proficiency, I think even male and female. But what the state of Alaska has to focus on in our accountability system is numbers of students that are proficient in reading, writing, and math. And if you meet a threshold that the courts can say, okay, yeah, that demonstrates to us that the majority of students have a meaningful opportunity, then you've fulfilled your constitutional obligation. I'll tell you, we've been very careful in not drawing that line because we're not sure where that line belongs. Is it 50% of the student population? Is it 40%? The court said a majority of the students. To me, that's more than 50%, but how much more than 50? So you can see here on this chart, the department's already intervening in the Upiat School District, Lower Yukon, Northwest Arctic, Yukon Flats, Yukon Koyukuk, and this year we'll be intervening in the Southwest Region School District. The districts that we're watching closely are over on the left-hand side of the chart there. But I would have to say that in some of those, it's because of those subgroup categories under the NCLB more so than the state accountability system.
So what I'm getting at is how far do we go as a state to look at each individual compared to what No Child Left Behind does, because they kind of say, well, we're not going to count this because you could identify them. So do we go look at each of those even though we don't have to for No Child Left Behind?
You're talking about the small, what do you call that, Les? Yeah, why don't you come on up. Identify this.
For the record, my name is Les Morris. I'm the Director of Assessment and Accountability for the Department of Education. I think what you're referring to is the small n size. And so for NCLB, when we evaluate a school, we evaluate the school as a whole, regardless of size, whether there's 10 students or 100 students. And our minimum n size then is 25. But again, at the school as a whole, we evaluate regardless of size. for all those subgroups, because we want to make sure we're making a reliable judgment, and the subgroups are the race and ethnic areas, special education, LEP, and students who are economically disadvantaged. For those groups, before we evaluate their performance in terms of language arts, which is reading and writing, and mathematics, we want to have assurance that there's at least enough students to have a very reliable judgment when we go to that subgroup level, and that's 26 or more students. When we're looking at the judgment of a school for a state accountability, what we're looking at is the overall school performance, where we're judging every student in two ways. How are they performing? What's their status? And how have they improved compared to the prior year? And we do look at every student and then every school. And so we are looking at all students in our system. But NCLB does as well at that school as a whole level. There's just more caution when you're looking at subgroups to make sure you're making a very reliable decision. And I hope that
Well,
clarifies.
I guess what I'm coming to is that with No Child Left Behind, if they don't have to count a subgroup because they're too small, then that school isn't put on the list of they need improvement. They need to do something because the other kids kind of were okay. And so what I'm saying is, so the list isn't the No Child Left Behind list, but is it the list that looks at every single student?
Chair Wilson, what we would urge in any state accountability system, we think it's important to look at every single student, regardless of what group they're in, to get a good judgment about how the school is doing. We also believe that the school in our state accountability system, regardless of NCLB, should look at subgroups so they see if they need to do target assistance in those subgroups, regardless of size. But we should make a judgment looking at every single student at the school as a whole level to get an overall sense of the school. Yet they may need to do some program improvements within special education, even though they may only have 15 students, and in NCLB that isn't measured. They still need to look at that and make a measurement. And just so that you know, that while it's not measured under NCLB, it is required to be reported. And so when they do their school report card to the public, they must report that student performance of that subgroup, as long as there are, there's a couple of rules, but it gets down to about five students. As long as there are five students who took the overall test, they have to report their performance and think about how they're going to improve that performance.
Okay, and I think that's important to have on the record because of the fact that what the state is doing versus what they could be doing that wasn't quite as deep. So I think that's important to have on the record.
Madam Chair,
Representative, Representative Fairclough has another question, but go ahead if you wanted to add something.
Well, Madam Chair, what I wanted to add to this discussion is, you know, NCLB, the targets that the state has to meet and the school districts have to meet keeps going up. And by 2014, we're supposed to have 100% of our students proficient in the state of Alaska. Well, if you're using that for your measurement as opportunity to learn under our state constitution, we're all going to fail here real quick. So where I try to take this discussion is, we have NCLB, the federal law over here that we have to deal with, and we have the state's constitutional obligation to provide a meaningful opportunity. But under both systems, we're using the same data. We're using the same assessment data to make the decisions that where we intervene at a state level versus what we have to do under NCLB. But it's the same data, but we have different results or different intervention strategies for the two different programs. Does that make sense?
I can clarify.
On that point, Representative Roses?
I think we're taking two different things and we're confusing the two. The state had their own accountability system, which is reported on the school report card. Every school has to do that, regardless of size, if five or more kids take the state assessments that we developed years ago. before NCLB came in. Under NCLB, you have another set of regulations that are based on what the federal requirements are, and that's when you hear the term adequate yearly progress. And in that area, there are 26 different litmus tests that have to be met, and you can fail in any one of those 26 and still be deemed not meeting adequate yearly progress. And some of those areas are what you were referring to, which was special education, ethnicity groups, and so on and so on. And it keeps going. If another way to fail is if a certain percentage of the student population doesn't show up to take the test. You fail because you don't have a certain percentage of the population testing. So there's lots of different ways. But they're two separate issues. The Moore case was based on the school report card with the state assessment. The Moore case had nothing to do with No Child Left Behind. It's a separate issue. And because with our state assessment, we use a progress model. That's why we have applied to No Child Left Behind to have them consider our progress model as part of whether we're determining that our schools are meeting an adequate yearly progress. So we're trying through a federal appeal process to mesh the two together more closely. And so that's part of what we were doing. And I think they granted us a pilot under that, didn't they?
Through the chair, Representative Roses. Yes, they've granted us a pilot to pilot a growth model under their conditions. So we're still running, actually, a dual growth model, one that we will definitely use in our accountability system and hopefully be able to improve our federal growth model to make good sense for Alaska's system.
Okay.
So it's two separate issues.
And I still think that nobody understands what I'm trying to get at, and I guess it's because I'm not presenting it well. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions, both to Mr. Slotnick and Mr. Jeans. Are we right now on the record setting the case for Judge Gleason to review?
Go ahead. Through the chair, Representative Faircloth. Setting the case?
She is going to, in establishing her ruling when she reviews in June, look to the committee conversation and documentation of what you present to see if the legislature has taken due course in establishing whether we believe the legislature has fulfilled its role.
That is absolutely correct.
And so why I'm saying this on the record to the committee is that we take an oath of office. And this is a little bit different hearing than if we were having a committee hearing. This could become quasi-judicial in the fact that it's being reviewed by a court. And so I just put on the record that my responsibility at this point is to defend the state of Alaska. That's how I see my role. I am not sitting just as a committee member. I am sitting as a person who's taken oath of office to protect the state of Alaska. And our department is trying to separate the two issues and appropriately speak to the court in whether we have established and met our constitutional responsibility under Article 7 of Health, Education, and Welfare to the public education system. And so if we so I just caution committee members that if we go off on rabbit trails, it may be hard for the court to see whether we're speaking to Alaska's the legislative constitutionality and upholding that versus No Child Left Behind. And if that gets murky, she could interpret that we were holding ourselves to the standard as a committee and as a legislature of looking at No Child Left Behind, and then she could find in her ruling that we were somehow deficient when we asked those questions. And so I would just say when we ask questions, we need to be very specific that we are trying to set a case whether we believe that we have fulfilled our responsibilities or we have not. And if we believe we have not, and we say that as a committee or as an individual representative, it may be pulled out in a later court finding to uphold more. And so I just say that for the record. It is a little bit different in how we might explore our opportunities, and I would just ask you to make sure that the words that you are choosing to put on the record that could be part of a court and used against the state of Alaska differently, that we consider that. And I just caution you because I've had it happen before, and I just want to be clear that the department and the Department of Education and Law are trying to be very succinct in what they're bringing to us. And so when we speak to that, understand we're speaking it we're speaking to a record that is setting the stage to be defended or taken apart in a lawsuit.
Well, as the chairman, I don't think that we should, I think we should ask the questions that we always ask, that we need to look at things that we always look at, and just because of this lawsuit doesn't mean that we should not ask the questions that are on our minds and that we think about.
Yeah.
So anyway, I want to caution you also that we should not be changing the way we do business just because of a lawsuit. So I understand where everybody's coming from, and I understand what you're saying, but I don't want this committee to be saying, oh my, we're going to have a lawsuit, so we're going to temper what we're saying, and we're going to be, you know, so I just want that to be said too. So,
Madam Chair, could I have a brief at ease?
Yes.
Great.
We had a discussion off net, I guess you might say here, to clarify what we're here for and why we're hearing this presentation. And it's not, we're not here to decide how our actions are as far as the court goes. We're here and to hear this presentation so that we can decide whether we need to go ahead and look at the bill that accompanies it to see if this bill is what we need to make sure that we're have the authority to do what we need to go and intervene in these schools. And so that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's what we're looking at. And we're not here to confirm whether the legislature is doing its job. And Representative Cisna, you had a question.
I have a question that I had before our intermission or our break. And that question is, in this, and I don't understand well enough, not being a part of the legal system, if a lawsuit is against, when it's the state of Alaska, is it the state legislature? Is it the other branch, the administration? And in that case, who are the people who are considered responsible? And if you could, in a legal way, Mr. Slotnick, tell us that, I'd appreciate that.
Through the chair, Representative Cisna, I'm not sure that I'm actually going to be able to give you a very good answer. Ultimately, the legislature is responsible. But, of course, the court can't order the legislature to do anything because it's separation of powers. There can't be such an order in the way that the laws that you make are executed are through the executive branch. So it's only going to be the executive branch that could respond to the orders from the court. So, and you see these things often, I think, traditionally in the prison litigation. It's there can be a standoff between the courts and the legislature, and we don't want to see that here. And I don't really think that's where we're headed. The lawsuit was against the state. It was the executive branch that responded. It was the executive branch that defended the lawsuit.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Roses.
Just a point of clarification, Madam Chair, on the statement you made that we're looking at this because we're looking at something to do with authority, and I just wanted to go on the record saying that I don't think this is anything about authority. I think the judge already said where the authority lies. But this is the third time I've seen this presentation, so I know what's to come. So I have an advantage over the rest of you. Really what we're doing with this presentation today, at least it's my intent, is that this is to set the stage for the bill that we have coming before us. And the bill that we have coming before us identifies a mechanism by which the Department of Education can capture funding to be able to go in on these intervention programs. And so it's a funding mechanism for that and gives them authority to withhold funds from a school district in order to do that. And that's what this bill that we're going to be hearing has to do. And so part of the presentation we're going to be seeing is presentation on how many schools they've had to do intervention in, and as to what that incorporates in terms of why this particular piece of legislation fits that presentation. And so I would go along with Representative Fairclough in the fact that we probably should be very cautious in terms of the way we ask the questions regarding the lawsuit, and probably at some point in time in the future may want to schedule a separate work session with this committee to drill down a little bit deeper if we want to get into authority and want to get into procedures and policies as to how we deal with what's going on here, because I know Representative Keller and I have spoken several times, and he has tremendous issues and concerns over about some of those very specific policies and procedures, but would be very reluctant to start asking any of those questions today without more detailed information until we really get to drill down a lot deeper and a lot more in detail as to what this is in some kind of a work session with this committee. So I think that's sort of where the discomfort was lying with some of us. So that's kind of where we're at. So
here's what my decision is. My decision is they're going to give a presentation, we are going to listen to it, and we're not going to discuss it today, because we will discuss it on Tuesday when we have the bill with us. So is that right?
The 25th.
So Representative Gardner. So write down your questions, and I'll have more information for you then. Representative Gardner.
So we're not going to be introducing and discussing Senate Bill 285 today?
Not today.
Okay.
And but write down your questions, because I think we do need to ask questions. And Representative Cisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I guess my question, again, and it kind of melds the two questions that I had asked, that talking about the fact that we're talking about a part of our state that is very different than even the part of the state that actually develops the program. And I personally am not particularly interested in the court case. I'm interested in legislation. And we're so different than administration in that we are made up of people from all over the state. And I would be very concerned myself that we make positive that we have members of our legislature who are from those areas at the table discussing the underlying thing that to this presentation in my mind, and that is that we actually have our schools meeting our goal, which is making sure our representatives get good education.
And really what was the bill was scheduled for today, to be heard today with this presentation. Mm-hmm. However, the bill sponsor was not ready to present the bill today, and that's why we don't have it today. And pending referral. But I talked with the sponsor yesterday, and they just weren't ready for it yet. So that's why we don't have the two together, and that does make it awkward. It would be much easier, but I don't want to not do the presentation now because they're here. So let's go ahead and finish the presentation, but we will have these same fellas here with us on the 25th so that we can ask them questions. So go ahead and do the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next chart that we want to get to is shows the test results for the schools that we have, for the districts we have intervened in. At the top here, you can see these are the reading scores. So they're probably backwards in your handout. The reading scores for the Upiat School District. The Department of Education intervened in the Upiat School District in 2005. And you can see from the this chart that we have seen improvement. The lower part, the far below proficient, went from 37% to 28 to 23. The below proficient went from 39 to 50 to 46, And then in the proficient category, it's 21.8 to 18. We had a little drop there, but then the subsequent year, it went up to 27%.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead. Continue.
Okay.
About the president, about this.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, it is about the presentation. What does an intervention look like?
The current intervention system, it requires the districts to develop a district improvement plan, which the department reviews and we negotiate with them. We require to have in that intervention program collaborative meetings with teachers on a weekly basis, that they're using state formative assessments. We have two assessment systems that are online that the schools have to use that we can track there at the Department of Education. This gives them almost immediate feedback in how to change their instructional practices or target instruction to children. We also require that they have leadership training both at the school and administrative level. Then the department requires the districts to hire through their Title I funds a district coach. And the coach works with the district to make sure that they're implementing the plan. And they report back to the department on that. So that's the foundation of the current intervention system.
Thank you, so, Madam Chair. Just in follow-up, so it's basically teacher training.
Teacher training
and support.
And principal and administrators training.
Thank you.
As well as using the state's formative assessment system so that we can monitor that they're actually using it. And then the collaboration meetings gives us feedback that they're actually using those assessments to change instructional practices.
Thank you.
And I actually met with the coaches that were doing this and talked with them, and they were presenting to each other how things were going in the schools that they were being the coaches for. It was very interesting, and I think that they're working very hard. Every once in a while, it's very frustrating for them. I think it's really good what the state is doing in these to have the coaches go.
Madam Chair, it somewhat parallels the mentorship program that we had a lot of
with a little bit
about.
Stronger, mm-hmm. you know.
Thank you.
Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to point out that in the first year of intervention, you're typically not going to see a whole lot of improvement, but it's that second and third year when we start to see real changes in test scores. Would you go to the next one? Here's the mathematics, and we see similar improvements that we saw on the reading assessments. Here again, Ubiate School District, we had 70% far below proficient in 2005. That dropped down to 54 and then 42. You can see that in the green, they only had 8% of their students proficient in 2005. That's up to 16 and now 23%. And we're expecting similar results in the 08 assessments, which we will be getting this spring. Madam Chair, I think we're done with that one. We do provide we have provided training to school districts in how they get into the intervention status. And in your handout, there's this PowerPoint presentation. And I only gave you a couple pages out of the PowerPoint that I wanted to highlight, but the website down at the bottom will get you to the entire presentation. Les Morris did this, put this together for school districts, because there was questions about what is it that the department looks at in determining when intervention is required. And to really summarize it for you, what we're looking for is increasing in student performance over the prior year. And that's what it all boils down to. Are you making gains with student achievement over the prior year? And so the first thing we do is we do a desk audit. And the desk audit is a review of data to try and determine the reasons the district has not demonstrated adequate yearly progress. Then we move into the instructional audit. Now, the instructional audit is the one that really gives us a lot of information. When we go on site and we look at their instructional policies, their practices, their methodologies, and we look at one or more schools within the district. And so that helps us come back and craft the district improvement or school improvement plan. The instructional audit, it looks at the curriculum and whether or not it's aligned to the state standards and grade level expectations. We look at their assessment policy and practices. We look at their instructional practices. We look at the school learning environment, the professional development policies and practices, and then we look at their leadership. So I think you can see that this starts to get right back to the three main pieces that the Department of Education requires to be included in the district improvement plans. Madam Chair, also included in your packet is a copy of some draft regulations that we will be taking to the State Board of Education at this March meeting. This gets to the school level audits. Right now, our instructional audits are based on a district level, but even in districts that are meeting AYP or moving forward, you may have some schools within that district that aren't actually showing improvement over the prior year. And we believe that the courts told us that we need to look at those individual schools. We have to drill down to that level. Here again, the interventions won't be directly with the school district or with the school. It will be through the district. It will be with the administration, the school board, and then the principal, the leader, instructional leader at that school. So all the interventions and collaboration will always go through the district administration and school board.
Eddie?
Yes, ma'am.
Where I'm reading on page one of the regulations here that says on line three, shall conduct a school level desk audit of all schools in the state. And so how are you going to do that? I mean, are you going to have more, hire more personnel to do that? Or,
Madam Chair, we're really already doing that with the data that we have. And if you look at the, follow that down a little further, what this regulation is doing is actually setting out the steps that we're going to look at and data that we're going to look at in determining whether or not we need to intervene with at a school level. So the first cut is, did the school make AYP? If the answer is yes, we don't go any further with that school. Maybe they didn't make AYP, but more than 50% of their students are proficient. If that's the case, we don't look any further. So what this is doing is setting up the system where we drill down through the data to determine whether or not student achievement is increasing over the prior year to make that determination whether or not the state has to intervene. So there's a number of factors that we'd be looking at there.
Okay, thank you.
Then, Madam Chair, the last piece of the handout is the actual draft Senate Bill 285 in its present form. I'm going to have to tell you there are going to be some more adjustments to it, dealing with when the state will turn over or return local control to the school district. And the Senate is looking for some real bright line level of information there, and so we're working with them on trying to develop that. Madam Chair, this chart up here illustrates the state's public school system, and I think it's important for us all to understand that the education clause applies to the state legislature. The state legislature provides funding in the education policy to the Department of Education. The Department of Education then, through our state board, we regulate and implement the policy. And right now, aligned with the courts is the standards, the assessment system, and then state oversight. And we provide that down to the district level. And this is where your local control comes in. So school districts are, under the court's eyes, expected to utilize the state standards and utilize the state assessment to educate children, and to educate children sufficiently that they should be able to pass the state exit exam. And so the relationship here from under the Constitution is from the Alaska State Legislature really all the way down to the child. And everything in between is simply an agent trying to execute the legislature's obligation to operate and maintain a public school system. And so, Madam Chair, I'd like to read a paragraph from the judge's decision, and this is on page 185 of the decision. It's paragraph 34, and this is really why we're here recommending the proposed piece of legislation. Alaska's Constitution makes the legislature, not local school districts, ultimately responsible for maintaining Alaska schools. Clearly, the legislature has authority to delegate that responsibility. And the court has found the legislature has provided the schools with a constitutionally sufficient amount of funds to undertake that responsibility. So here the court is saying, you're adequately funded. But the state's responsibility does not end with adequate funding. If the school, despite adequate funding, is failing to accord a child with a constitutionally adequate education, such a failing to give the child a meaningful opportunity to acquire proficiency in the state's own performance standards, then the concept of local control must give way because the school is not being maintained as required by the education clause. So the state of Alaska is not fulfilling its obligation to the individual students if, through local control, a child is not being afforded a meaningful opportunity to acquire the education. Madam Chair, the reason the department has not come before this legislature prior to this is all relatively new to us as well. And, you know, in developing the accountability system, the experience that we're gaining through the interventions that we're currently involved in, but it's time for the legislature to consider legislation that basically puts school districts on notice that if you can't fulfill the obligation under the Constitution, then the state absolutely has an obligation to come in and direct instructional practices within a school district, maybe sometimes down to the school level. Currently, the district coaches, as I mentioned, we require the districts to hire them using Title I funds. And so it puts a district coach in a very awkward position where they're being paid by the school district, but they're really acting as an agent of the Department of Education. We'd like to change that. The Department of Education would like to be the one that hires the district coaches, pays the district coaches, and directs their activities at the local level. As I mentioned earlier, the Senate is asking for a bright line when local control will be returned to the school district. And like I said, we're working with them on that piece. So I fully expect that component to be included in the proposed legislation when it comes over to this body. So, Madam Chair, that concludes our presentation on the Moore versus State case, why we're here before you today, and why we're asking you to consider Senate Bill 285 when it comes over to this body.
I do want to make a comment about when I visited with the coaches. The majority of them didn't have any problems as far as cooperation from the school. I didn't, at the time when I was talking with them, realize the extent there were, I won't say the number, but there were some coaches that were having some problems, and I don't know if it was from the local school board at that level or whether it was the superintendent or the principal. I mean, I don't know where the problem was coming from, but they weren't allowed only into the the district office and no further. They couldn't go to another school, you know. And so when that happens, we, I think, as legislators or as the Department of Education, need to have the authority to go further than that. And the only authority we have to do that is to say, okay, if you don't have cooperation, then we're not going to give you your money or something like that. And so I think that's where this all is going or coming from, Representative Sisson.
Madam Chair, I keep finding myself still wondering about special needs, about those people who you can do anything and everything possible, and with children who are born with conditions or maybe have a brain injury, or I mean there's numerous things happen that at least in many of these, the standards that we're trying to get to, we're not going to get to. We can do every single thing we possibly can, and we can take control away from the local government, and it's the state government. We're still not going to meet those standards with those people. And so your purpose here is not to talk about that, except for that doesn't that come into this mix?
Go ahead, Eddie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Representative Sisna, the Constitution does not require that every child meet the state standards. What it requires is that they have the opportunity. Okay. Through this court proceedings, the courts found that there was not sufficient evidence that the state put forth its best efforts. I think the judge clearly recognized there are going to be students that don't perform. There are going to be issues outside the walls of the school that are going to impact student learning. What the Department of Education can impact is those activities within the walls. And where we see that districts or a particular school is not increasing student achievement from one year to the next, the courts is saying you have an obligation to get in there and try to impact instructional practices. And as long as we can demonstrate that, I think we're going to be fine with the courts. But there just wasn't enough of that evidence at this proceeding.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Keller. And then we've got 45 minutes to finish the rest of our program because we have another meeting coming in. So I'd like to get to the next bill. So go ahead.
I just wanted to ask if in the regulations it talks about restructuring of schools and talks about EED's involvement in personnel decisions when they get at a certain point. We've had schools in that category. I was just wondering what EED, if anything has been done in that. You know, have you been involved in districts and schools at that level before the court case or now?
Through the Chair, Representative Keller, in the Ubiad School District, that's three communities. We were involved in all three communities. Two of the schools worked cooperatively with the department to implement the district improvement plan. In one school, we had pushback from the principal. Eventually, the district dealt with that principal, but it was a year later. And so what these proposed statutes and regulations are saying is it's taken that whole question of local control off the table. You know, because when we intervene in districts right now, one of the first questions that comes up is, does the department really have authority to do this? You know, we're a local control state. You can't tell us what to do. Well, with this piece of legislation, then the message that's being sent out there is the legislature supports the activities that the Department of Education is engaged in to attempt to improve student achievement.
So you're saying that there's some question, not that it's true or false, but there's some question whether or not the regulations were, you know, solidly based enough on statute. And what you're saying is that the judge's decision there bypasses all that then and gets us into another level of looking at the legislature's impact on the instruction in the school districts.
To the Chair, Representative Keller, what I'm saying is the judge made it very clear that if local control is not working and student achievement is not increasing for a majority of the students, the legislature has an obligation to put forth its best effort. The Department of Education is your agent in putting forth your best effort.
And we will discuss this on the 25th when the rest of the when the bill comes up. So thank you very much, both Eddie and
Neil.
And we appreciate your presentation. And now we are next. We'll bring up Senate Bill 119, the school library program. And if you will remember, we heard this bill last Tuesday. And so I'm hoping that we won't have it. We stayed over to hear all the testimony. And we closed public testimony last week. I do not plan to take any more testimony, but I also plan to move this bill from committee today. So, Jenny, would you and Darwin please come forward? Each of the committee members has a handout on the desk concerning a couple of issues that came out in the last meeting. And would you please speak to the opinion that you got back from Ledge Legal? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Darwin Peterson, staff to Senate Finance Committee under Senator Stedman. At the request of Representative Seaton, we ordered a legal opinion from Legislative Legal answering two questions. One, whether or not a community that's in unincorporated Alaska could be considered a community that could publicly own a public library, and two, whether a school district or an REAA could qualify for a grant. And the response that we received back from Legislative Legal was that the communities that would qualify as a public entity to own a library is under interpretation, subject to interpretation by a court. So if the committee felt it necessary to clarify that those communities are communities that are within a municipality, it would be under your discretion to do so. The second part of the question with regard to whether or not a school district could qualify for a grant, the Legislative Legal Division said that yes, they could. However, eligibility requires that an applicant for a grant provide matching funds, so that requirement may be difficult for school districts to satisfy under their local contribution limits.
Okay. Well, I do know that in some communities there's active fundraising going on to work toward that. So I guess.
Madam Chair, if I may, it's the understanding of the sponsor and the Senate Finance Committee that this would be self-policing, that those small communities that we are concerned about wouldn't have the ability to raise the 20% matching funds needed for the construction of a public library.
Okay. Thank you very much. Does the committee understand the concern here? And so you're saying that if we take the words local government entity and substitute municipality, that would help?
Madam Chair, yes, that would clarify that only those communities that are in organized Alaska would qualify for the grant. It wasn't the intent of the committee to do that. That's why we left it rather broad, because if some of the larger communities in unorganized Alaska have the ability somehow to raise the 20% matching funds, we want them to be able to qualify. We don't anticipate that will happen very often, but if they are able to do that, we would like them to be able to participate in the program.
Okay. And where is that worded in the bill?
It's actually page 2, line 11 was the concern that Representative Seaton had under eligibility, that the library had to be publicly owned and operated. His concern was with the small communities in unorganized Alaska. If they don't have a municipality umbrella over them to help contribute with the financial costs, that they wouldn't be able to participate. And if you wanted to further define publicly owned and operated as owned by a municipality, that would clarify that only those communities that have a taxing structure in place that belong to a municipality would be eligible.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. So it's very clearly the intent of the sponsor that tribal organizations or a nonprofit library group would not be eligible.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, a tribal organization would be considered a community if they are a tribal organization that represents one community. So if the tribal organization on behalf of a community could provide 20% matching grants, then they would qualify. Because the word community is very nebulous, and it was the intent of the sponsor to make it that way, so that a first-class city or a municipality or any community that could come up with 20% matching grants could participate in the program.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For further clarity, then, the sponsor would like to leave the legislation as presented so that it's broader to incorporate that flexibility. But Representative Seaton had asked for a possible honing down with new language.
But through the chair, Representative Faircloth. I'm not sure if Representative Seaton actually wanted it to be honed down. I think he just wanted it to be clarified, which was the purpose for requesting the legal opinion. But yes, you are correct that it is the sponsor's intent to leave it broad.
Okay, Representative Keller?
She asked me a question.
Okay.
Beat me to it.
All right, good. Any other questions? What are the wishes of the committee? Representative Faircloth.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I do have another question. On page 3, line 20, talks about documentation must include submission of library class schedules, job descriptions for library staff, and a copy of an annual budget. I'm just kind of curious about why the job description for the library staff and would be included.
I'm going to see if I can have my expert come up. Can you
come and answer that question? Kathy? Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Clark Greening. I work as a lobbyist with the Alaska Library Association. And I brought an assistant here who actually is a school librarian. Mm-hmm. Kathy?
I'm Kathy Boutin. I'm a librarian here in Juneau, and I'm testifying as an individual today.
I'm going to take a swing at that particular question, Representative Gardner, through the chair. I think this is to set, in terms of developing regulations, give some background. If the department develops the regulations that will actually make these grants competitive, particularly if there's not enough money. And one of the things I think they want to determine with this documentation is what level of support the district currently supplies to the school library. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Kathy.
Just that we're interested in having really working libraries represented here. Not a classroom collection, but an ongoing working library to assist children in a library fashion.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Rosen?
I was waiting. She looked like she might have had a follow-up, so I hesitated. I do have a question on page 3, and two questions. The first would be starting on line 23 on page 3, where it says, a library collection development grant may be used only to purchase library collection materials by a public school or by a school district if the district operates a correspondence program. Does every one of the school libraries in the state operate a correspondence program?
Denny Osterman, I don't have the answer to that question. I don't know.
And so, if I may follow up.
So
would it be your understanding that this language would not provide money to any schools unless they did?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Okay. Would it be a surprise to you to know that most correspondence programs aren't run through the libraries, that they're run through the instructional division of the schools? And so, therefore, probably none of the libraries would qualify?
As I understand the wording, it says a public school
where the district operates the correspondence program. Am I misunderstanding your question?
Yeah. I just have a little bit of a concern because I'm not sure that we have every district in the state operates a correspondence program.
Representative Roses, through the chair, this is only hearsay, because I understand that they do, or at least required to. So I can't answer directly that every single library, but I think nearly all, if not all, do. But we can get that clarified.
Okay, Representative Faircloth.
Madam Chair, if there's no other questions, I'm move that SB 119 version L from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal note number 4 that was passed out of Senate rules.
Okay, hearing no objection.
I have an objection just for discussion. Okay. Section, well, on page 3, under eligibility requirements, are eligibility requirements generally established in statute or by regulation?
Can you talk to that?
There has to be enough guidelines in the statute to allow them to do it by regulation. If you go to the top of the page 3, actually, mm-hmm. a partial phrase, it refers to the department. You have to go to the page 1. They establish regulations that are, let's see, I've got to make sure I got the right page here, to the highest rank applicants according to criteria established by the department and regulation. And down here it gives some of the guidelines for the department, that's the Department of Education, to establish those regulations.
Representative Roses.
It's not a question, but a statement. I'm not going to oppose this bill moving, but I will tell you that when the concept first came forward, the only part that was being introduced by the Library Association was the second part, which had to do with the library development grants, and then it morphed into a construction grant along with that. And so I have still have some serious concerns and reservations about the construction part of it. When we start limiting it to communities with populations of 10,000 or less, we're targeting a very specific group. And so I'm going to have some real concerns about that, but I'm not going to hold the bill in committee as a result of that. But unless somewhere along the line it may be a no vote when it gets to the floor, but at this point I'm not going to hold it up. That's where my concerns are.
Okay, Representative Keller.
To add to that, pretty much the same boat. I don't want to stand in the way of the bill, but I want to point out it does go to finance and gets a good review.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the issue of establishing eligibility requirements in statute as opposed to regulation, it won't kill the bill as far as I'm concerned at all, because I actually do like the bill a lot. But I think it makes things unnecessarily cumbersome if it turns out that somebody wants to change eligibility requirements, and then it's difficult to do that if it's in statute. So, yeah, I'll remove my objection, Madam Chair.
That objection is removed, and hearing no other objection, this bill has passed. And for all the librarians out there in the audience listening, I'm sure they are happy, but I'm sure also that finance will probably look at this bill differently than we are. Mm-hmm. But right now, that bill passed, and there is no money attached to it at all. Okay. Next bill we have is House Bill 386, Energy Subsidy for Schools. And Representative Ledoux is unable to be with us today, so one of her staff is here with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Thomas Brown. I'm an intern in the office.
House Bill 386 was drafted in response to a request made by several school boards throughout the state. In the last year and a half, gas prices have gone over 100%. With too many school districts facing an absurd increase in costs while facing a simultaneous decrease in enrollment. That is important to remember that the cost of either building remains the same no matter how many students are actually in that building, 10 or 15 or 100, the cost of each building stays the same. The foundation formula currently used to calculate school funds is inadequate to address these skyrocketing costs at the moment. A number of school districts are already using methods and new technologies to mitigate their energy consumption and energy costs. Plugging holes in the ceiling windows, closing down certain sections of the school that are no longer being used, cutting programs, reducing the hours of hourly employees. The problem is that these are not universal solutions. Some of them are impractical in some districts, impossible in other districts, and a majority of them, like the high technology solutions, like switching to a different alternative energy source, are just cost prohibitive in most districts. You have pretty much all the same info in front of you that I have in front of me, so I won't bore you with a bunch of numbers and statistics, and I'll just leave you open to ask any questions you might have.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We just passed the largest education package that positively benefits schools and school districts across the state of Alaska in a decade. It did not reduce the student base allocation, even though the state stepped up under a PERS and TERS contribution that's in a supplemental that's on the House floor. And I know we're not supposed to speak to other subsidies, but can you speak to why we would further, after we've created we've held a floor now at a PERS TERS contribution of 22% and did not negatively reduce the allocation?
To the Chair, Representative Fairclough, you're speaking of the recently passed House Bill 73, result of the Joint Legislative Task Force, Education Task Force of the Senate.
That was one component of what I'm speaking to.
I believe we have someone here, Mr. Carl Rose, who can speak to that more precisely. From my understanding, it is the numbers that they used for that were based on the ICER report. They only used 50% of the recommended numbers from the ICER report.
And I would like to make a comment about that. That 50% was the same 50% that they gave us the year before, so that was not an increase for many people. So I know my own school, the difference in my town is $12,000 a year. That's how much more we got over last year. So even though it sounds like it's great, it doesn't come forth and fit all everywhere that great. And that's if we don't lose any students. So I don't think we need to discuss other bills. And are there any other questions? Jim Nygaard, would you come forward and give us your testimony?
My name is Jim Nygaard, Superintendent of Schools for Cordova School District. I'm here to speak in support of the bill, share some information on what we've done in Cordova to try to curb some of the costs, and then be available for some specific questions from each of you. I sent out some information earlier. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to make the flight. So I'm going to kind of highlight, I'm not sure if you have it in front of you or not, highlight some of the points that I had sent to Mr. Brown. First of all, in Cordova, our fuel bills increased 372% since FY03. Just for budget purposes for next year, between our fuel and our health care alone, it contributes to a $150,000 increase to what our budget will be expecting, in fact. The obvious things we mentioned, cut the thermostat down, disallow heat to certain areas. We do, in one of our buildings, have computerized climate control. So on Friday afternoons, the heat shuts down, the boilers go down, circulation all shuts down until early Monday morning. So we are being especially critical of that. We maintain our boilers at premium efficiency, make sure the nozzles are the right size, make sure they're clean, make sure the boiler itself is clean on a regular basis. We have the optimum performance out of that. I've even gone so far as to take the door closures off all the exit doors. Sometimes when you're hauling equipment back and forth, you can prop the door open. I've taken that piece of equipment off so the doors can't be propped open by people by mistake. That said, our fuel consumption has gone down, and I'm excited to share that. But the overall costs continue to erode our general fund. I attached a couple of graphs just for easy reference, and again, I'm assuming you have these graphs.
We didn't get them, I don't think.
Well, if it was in the packet, I produced one of the forms.
Is this what you're talking about?
No.
Yeah, I don't think I have it.
Again, even with the drop of enrollment that Cordova experiences, it's necessary to keep our classrooms at an adequate temperature. Realizing that, we try to make as efficient use of our buildings as possible. In our elementary building, for example, we cut through attrition of our staff as the room becomes available. We're anticipating moving our district office into a couple of vacant classrooms so we can close down our district office altogether and try to be as responsible to our city council and our school board as we can. Other efforts that we've done in Cordova, our elementary school was built in 1963. Our city council recently financed a condition survey to bring in some expert engineers and architects to give us some specific suggestions on what we do to make our building more efficient. Again, the obvious things of insulation. It's kind of scary what's between the walls of a building built in 1953. Computerized heat controls are not available in that building, but it's something that we're looking very, very heavily at right now. Other areas that we've done to compensate the large void, again, responsible staff cuts through attrition. Electric bills have been reduced based on the conditional studies. Frequency drives on our larger electric motors, timer sensors on all of our outside lights, again, have helped us with our electric costs. Everything's got a fuel surcharge attached to it, so almost not directly related to this bill. I feel it's important that you understand responsible approach that we're taking on it. We've looked at insurance carriers, cutting our flow out of our general fund again. And with the support of Representative Thomas and Senator Tukich, we're pursuing installation of a waste oil burner. I put a couple numbers here in front of you for reference. A small burner, 3 gallons an hour. When you do the math, it could come up to as many as 20,000 gallons a year. When our larger boilers burn up to 26 gallons of fuel an hour, it doesn't sound like 3 gallons of waste oil being burned an hour very much. But when you do the math at a basic $4 a gallon, I just fueled up my pickup the other day and diesel was $5. But potential savings of up to $80,000. And again, it's trying to be a responsible approach to some of the costs and provide a service for the community at the same time. And even with that option, it requires some additional burden to keeping that boiler clean and efficient, so it's not a cumbersome addition to our district. We want to make sure that we're responsible to the local people as well. Again, the fuel costs in the last 4 years have gone up 372%, and the when you look at the price of oil going up, as far as the export off the North Slope, the higher the price of that oil gets, the further the resources get away from our kids and our families. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess with that, I appreciate the opportunity to come in and share my support for the bill, and I'm open for some questions. If you have some requests for additional information, I appreciate the opportunity.
Representative Roses.
Thank you. Did you receive any kind of funding over the last 2 years to help offset your increases in energy costs? And if I'm looking at the chart correctly here, your energy cost, and I assume this is all heating oil, electricity, everything that's included in this cost, for 07 actuals was $398,065, and then the projected for 08 was $523,057 for an increase of roughly $125,000. But if this bill passed, the amount of money that you would get through this bill would be actually $199,000. So not only does it cover 100% of the increase from the prior year, but it also would cover, you know, an additional $72,000 on top of that. So I guess my question would be, what did you do in your budgeting process from last year to this year to cover your projected energy costs? Because at that time, there was no discussion about a bill to offset 50% of the total costs. So how did you budget for it?
And I may have misunderstood your initial question. You asked if we got additional funding. I was assuming you were talking specific to fuel costs.
I was talking about energy assistance.
The money that we're budgeting, that we're targeting for the fuel issue, comes from the efforts of the legislature this last session with cost differential increases. The impact for our district through current legislation will be slightly more than $250,000 for insurance, healthcare. The overall increases that we're anticipating, I see what on the graph, so it'll be the same way you're looking at.
Oh, this is a chart.
I'm looking at an increase of fuel alone was, I believe it was an $80,000.
For reference, what I'm referencing, Mr. Nygaard, is with Department of Education Early Development put together a chart for us that has the actual FY07 energy costs as they were submitted to the Department of Education under the auditing process, and then the forecast for FY08 energy costs, and then a forecast for FY09 energy costs. And so that's the chart that I'm referring to. So based on the actuals for 07 and the projections for 08, in your district there's roughly $125,000 increase for 08 over 07. And what I was referring to was in this bill passed, you would actually receive $199,000, which would cover all of your increased costs from 1 year to the next, in spite of how you budgeted for that increase, and as well as an additional $72,000 above what your increase projections were. So. Part of this for me is I understand the burden that the districts have. There's no question about it. Every district does as you look through it. But
I may be looking at a different chart again. The chart I'm looking at shows an increase of $40,000.
For Cordova?
Correct.
We've got some different. At the top it says energy costs in Alaska school districts, and it has all the schools.
From 07 to 08.
We're actually looking from 05 to 08.
In mine, I'm just looking at the 07 one.
Oh, so you aren't looking.
Mine says page 2 of 2, and it's the energy cost analysis that is accompanying House Bill 386, updated 3/10/2008 is the one I'm looking at.
That's this one.
What we reported to Department of Education.
No,
that's not it. Yeah, there's it over right there.
Mm-hmm. It's right behind the fiscal notes.
Yeah. Oh. 398.
Yes.
Yes, the first page after the fiscal notes.
Okay, so then we have what you're looking at is $398,000 versus $622,000.
From 07 to 09, correct. So I guess my question was, in building your budget for 08 after the 07 actuals, somewhere in there you designed a budget to help cover those projections of cost, even though I realize they've gone up above what we probably projected. And it's already been mentioned about the area cost differentials, and part of the funding mechanisms for those area cost differentials and the reason they're established is because of the difference in fuel costs compared to Anchorage. I also realized that last year a one-time fix was made that gave you the area cost differentials, and this year that didn't go up. All we did was move it over into statute, so there's no increase in revenue other than the additional percentage of the 100 BSA, so there's still that, so which is a small amount. But
I think what you're asking is, what did you have to cut out to make up because you knew you were going to have higher costs?
And he's already.
Or did you have to do that?
Yeah, he already mentioned that.
Okay.
If you could. Again, I'm only assuming you've gotten some of this information. Cutting all areas, looking at our health care costs. We're looking at higher deductibles. We're implementing HRAs to offset that. We're looking at cutting our staff to attrition, trying to squeeze when possible. I referenced earlier how we're looking at closing our district office, moving into a vacant classroom of our elementary school. And those are all areas that we're looking at very heavily. The comparisons of what the impact of a waste load burner does to keep our heat costs down and really dependent on those dollars to make up.
Okay, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you. Does the graph that you've presented us today reflect the bill that we've already passed and signed into law with the new education dollars coming to Cordova?
Yes, it does.
With what the governor's passed?
Yes, that's true.
And how about the supplemental that's sitting on the House floor?
I'm not familiar with the impact that will have on us.
Thank you.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of my questions would be, in listening to you describing all of the efforts that you go through to try to harness the loss of fuel and then the increase in price, it sounded like some of the things that you're doing actually create safety issues, not being able to prop doors open, that kind of thing. Have you?
It's not a safety issue.
Okay.
I'm talking exit doors. We're not talking fire exchange type doors. When people are going in and out for activities, we sometimes have doors that when you open them up, it is locked open. And my comment was, we take those mechanisms off, so the door opens automatically swings closed. And those are only on exit doors.
Okay, and if I may
follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the other question I would have is, what are the programs that you've curtailed that relate to education that take place after the normal school hours? Because it sounds like you close the building down the minute you can, turn down the heat, that kind of thing. Has your educational package actually been reined in terms of time using the school?
Not because of teacher strengths.
Okay.
Our high school is computerized. We can adjust that daily. We have automatic overrides. We have activities that often run. You know, it's a small community. The school is the hub. So we do overrides on a regular basis. Our elementary school does not have the privilege of a computerized system. So a lot of our tutorials after school we hold at the elementary school because of the heat issue.
Okay, thank you.
And also want to comment that is this the first year at that school? For what they did in the past, it might be a little difficult for him because this is his first year in that school. Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to do is ask, we're going to have to close down because at 11 there is another committee, but is there anybody here in the audience that will not be able to be here again? I'm thinking of people that flew in or anything like that. So And I, the people that are online, sorry we didn't get to you today, but please be online again the next time we have this bill. And I'm not sure at this point. I don't have the schedule, so I don't know when it'll be. But anyway, we will have to. I'm not going to close down testimony, however, because we do need to have the testimony on the rest of it. So having said that, we will adjourn. Thank you.